You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. Hey, everyone. We have our first class of 2023 coming up, and it's going to be called One Nation Under God. And it's going to be on this idea that you've probably heard swirling around for quite some time, Christian nationalism. And it's going to be taught by Dr. Sam Perry.
Dr. Perry, great guy, is an award-winning scholar and teacher who is among the nation's leading experts on conservative Christianity and American politics, race, sexuality, and families. And he's the co-author of the incredibly insightful book, Taking America Back for God and the Flag and the Cross. Now, this course that he's teaching is January 6th. Ring a bell? January 6th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And the class is, like all our classes, pay what you can. And it's available for you to buy now at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/one nation. That's one word.
And since it's a live class, the pay what you can window will close. And then the recording will cost $25. So if you do want the pay what you can, that's available now. And again, there's a short window. So go ahead and sign up thebiblefornormalpeople.com/one nation. Alternatively, for only $12 a month, you can become an all-access member of our new community, the Society of Normal People. And as part of that $12 a month, you get access to all of our classes for free as part of that membership.
Not just this one, all of them.
All of them. So if you think that you might want to participate in future classes or have access to previous classes, I would suggest maybe just consider going to the Society of Normal People, which you can get to. Just go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join, and you can join for the all access.
I mean, 12 bucks a month.
12 bucks a month.
You can't afford not to do that.
That's right.
That's what I look at.
Or, you know what? You could do both, you know? We're not going to turn down your money.
You could give us $50,000 and join the Society of...
Exactly, for $12 a month. You could do both.
It sounds good to me.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. So again, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/one nation.
Welcome, everybody, to this, our last episode of the sixth season of the Bible for Normal People podcast. The only God-ordained podcast on the internet.
That's correct. Yes. But I'm trying to think of the Bible verse. I think it's morning, maybe lasts through the night, but joy comes in the morning.
Yeah. And?
So you can cry for a while, but we do have season seven.
We do have season seven, right.
But you have to wait till February.
I'm not sure if I can make it that long.
Yeah.
And I think I speak for everyone listening right now.
You can't wait
long
to listen to your own voice?
Exactly. Exactly. I'm a teacher, for heaven's sake. That's what I do, man. That's what I do for a living. So anyway.
All right. Well, for this episode, we thought, you know, in years past, we've done a recap. But rather than doing a recap, we'll just say, go back and listen to all the other episodes. I mean, my goodness, why do we have to do the work?
We'll have to hold your hand.
But instead, we're going to just, we're going to ruin Christmas.
You know, we're going to do a precap.
Oh, we're going to do a precap.
A precap, because Christmas isn't yet.
That's true.
It's a precap.
It's a precap. I like that.
I like that, too. It's a precap.
We're going to ruin Christmas. If you go to your, you know, Hallmark store and buy a nativity set, and there's a lot of inaccuracies in that depiction from the biblical narrative.
Exactly,
but
right.
We need to respect and be grounded in the scholarship. We need to know that Jesus was not a white person. And we also need to have an imagination and be creative about how we bring that ancient tradition to our lives today.
So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Frische Netzsekt, verschiedene Sorten, je 0,75 Liter Flasche nur 3,49 Euro. Und außerdem Emira Klettscheiben, Natur, je 200 Gramm Packung nur 2,22 Euro. Sichere dir außerdem bis zum 24. Dezember 10% Rewe Bonusguthaben auf Weihnachtssüßwaren. Nur in deiner Rewe-App. Frohe Weihnachten. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Let's start. We wanted to start maybe on a personal note, because we want to talk about tradition, culture, the Bible, and all that surrounding Christmas. So we thought maybe start with our personal traditions. How did you celebrate Christmas, Pete, growing up or now? How has that shifted, changed? What did you like about it? What did you hate about it?
A whole bunch of stuff. So, I grew up in a home of German immigrants. And so we always celebrated Christmas Eve. That's when we opened our presents. And I always thought it was odd that people had to wait till the next morning. So we just, that was what we did. And we usually would buy our tree and just decorate it the week of, not like a month early. You know, I mean, actually, my mother grew up, they got the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve. That was sort of their thing, but we didn't do that. So, yeah.
Wow.
And then we went to church, and then I couldn't wait to get back home because I didn't want to go to church Christmas Eve. And then just Sunday was just a day of hanging out and stuff. My mother always made flounder, too, so we had that. And in terms of our adult years, you know, you never keep the same traditions, but you know, when our kids were young, we sort of would light an Advent wreath and read a Bible verse or something until they didn't want to do that anymore, which happens. I have this weird tradition. I always go to an academic conference called the Society of Biblical Literature, also the American Academy of Religion, same thing. Anyway, that's always the weekend before Thanksgiving. And on the plane ride home, I put in my earbuds, and that's when I start listening to Christmas music. That's my little tradition, and I really look forward to it because I have all these Christmas songs and carols and things like that, and I have like 15 that are my favorite. So I usually play that on a loop, you know, for the trip home, and that gets me into it. And then when I come home, that's when I put up the outside Christmas lights. So I do those kinds of things, and it feels like it's almost a liturgy, you know, it really is. It's almost a liturgy, and that's what I like doing. And then, you know, usually, you know, we've transitioned to Christmas morning, but of course now, you know, the kids aren't in the house anymore, so they do their own thing, but it winds up being traveling at Christmas time. That's what you do, right? So, So stuff like that. I mean, you know, there's certain ways of decorating the house, you know, things like that, but yeah. That's sort of what Christmas means to me.
Yeah. It's so heartwarming. I feel like we need a hearth.
We do have a wood-burning stove, so we do that. You
nice.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let me see. For me, as you were talking, I had these flashbacks because I like how you did that in terms of from when you were a kid and then with your kids older. And so growing up for us, a big thing had to be a real tree.
Oh, yeah.
I think my parents had a... You know, the thought of, well, it's easier, it's cheaper, we could just give it to a store. And I think we almost like had a riot on our hands.
Yeah,
we
were, I mean,
like,
no. Jesus had a real tree.
Exactly.
So, you know, why would you do that?
Exactly.
So,
and I thought my family were Christians, and then they suggested a fake tree. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know. So, yeah, and then you mentioned music. I wasn't going to share this because I hadn't thought of it. But when you said music, at our house, Christmas was the time that you got this tape out. And it was a mixtape, and it was put out by Marlboro, the cigarette company. And my parents had smoked, so we got this tape. I guess that's what you did for marketing back then. Mm-hmm. I guess to sell more cigarettes, you gave out cassette tapes of Christmas songs. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was like our soundtrack to Christmas. Yeah, we right. got it out, put the cassette tape in, and thus you could begin Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then for me, a little later, mine was a particular album by Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
And that was my soundtrack. That was my way to rebel against the Marlboro cassette tape.
Yeah.
It was like, well, my Christmas is Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
That's a really great soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to some of that too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It was good.
You know, the thing is though that, I mean, I just if you guys will indulge me, there's one memory I didn't mention, but we always have stockings hanging over the fireplace. How original is that, right? Just don't get them too close to the fire because they burn up. Anyway, so what we did when the kids were young, we would go to church Christmas Eve and the stockings were empty when we left for church. And then one of us would like, oh gosh, I forgot my wallet. Go run in and fill the stockings. And so we'd get home and say, oh, I wonder if Santa was here, right? And of course he was. And it's like, remember Eric when he was like maybe 8, like, how did this happen? It's like, he still hadn't figured it out. But we broke the news to him a couple years later. But that's,
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what it is about Christmas. For some people, it's a very, very difficult holiday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just to acknowledge that, for many people, it's like the warmest time of the year. I don't know why, but it is. It's just, I think it's so deeply ingrained in American culture, Western culture, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I would be remiss if I didn't also share the other part of our tradition growing up, you know, more conservative evangelical, And that is the idea of Jesus is the real reason for the season. That was often said in our house, which is interesting because, you know, it wasn't liturgical. It wasn't like, oh, we follow the 12 days of Christmas and we really follow Advent and, you know, going to church. And it wasn't liturgical. That's not what it meant, that Jesus was the reason for the season. It was more like making sure that we would be disappointed if the Kmart employee said Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas. Right. Like, that's kind of the stuff, which is interesting now seeing a broader view of the church, where a lot of the church, it's funny that Jesus was the reason for the season, but that for me was always disconnected from the church. We didn't do a lot of church stuff for Christmas. Mm-hmm. It was just a culture war.
Yes, right, idea. Exactly, right.
That's what it means.
Christmas getting wrapped up.
While there are, wars. Which is just interesting, because then there were like millions of Christians who were like actively celebrating liturgically this Christmas season, which, you know, we didn't do. I think a couple of years we made a birthday cake for Jesus or something, which I think was like an early 90s evangelical Christian thing to do
for
Christmas.
We never did that. No, oh, you know what? We sang Happy Birthday to Jesus. That's what we did. Oh, gosh. I remember now. Oh, no. Jared, yes. we need a therapist here on hand as we go through this.
I mean, it makes sense. Again, it is a blending of traditions, right? Like, okay, we're celebrating the birth of Jesus. Well, what do we do in 20th century America for birthdays? We make a cake and sing Happy Birthday. Yeah. And so, you know, it's this merging of
contextualization,
these.
Contextualization, as they call it, right?
Right, so, yeah. Right. Yeah. And now that our kids are older, you know, we did also the Advent thing, wreath and calendars and stuff like that, but they've kind of grown out of that. And for us, you know, one thing that actually I appreciate for us is we haven't really focused too much on presents, because I also, when I was in my 20s and even into my 30s, there was a sense that for a lot of moms in particular, Christmas is a very stressful time.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Because it's like gifts for the teachers, gifts for your friends, Christmas parties you have to go to, getting gifts. It's a lot to, there's a lot of expectation for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of wanted out of that rat race. And so we just didn't do those things because it just seemed stressful and we didn't want it to be a stressful time.
Right. That's a really good point. It is stressful.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, that's part of what they don't like about it is like these expectations and the
and
stress.
And if people are alone, again, the stress and the expectations that you're not fulfilling and you just have to take ownership of your life and not buy into that. But it's hard, you know, this is all around
it's
us.
It's tricky. Yeah. Because there are a lot of social pressures. Right. And that's why, you know, for me, I hear that a lot from women who tend to carry a lot more of that function in the household anyway. And then for Christmas, it's like amped up.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more expectation to do even more. And that can just be not life-giving.
So. And not that we have to answer the question, but I always wonder, why is that? Like, why do we do that to ourselves? And maybe fitting in or something, being a part of stuff, you know, not the fear of being left out, fear of missing.
Well, and the fear not wanting to disappoint people.
Yeah, but we've set up these expectations where people would be disappointed.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like over time you build expectations and then it's like to drop out of that is to disappoint someone.
I hate Christmas.
Oh my gosh. This just took a turn.
Folks, I don't hate Christmas. But no. I wish I would. Every year, I mean, I remember we would say like, we just need to simplify Christmas. It never happened.
Really?
Maybe you bought a few fewer things, but it never really happened. Like, let's not get any presents. Let's just give the money to a homeless shelter. But we never got around to doing that because I think the pressure to conform was too much.
Yeah. I would say, you know, we did, it helps that I don't feel like we ever did buy into it. I think if we had done it for a while and then wanted to simplify, that would have been really hard because you're like taking things away. Mm-hmm. Where for our kids, they just didn't expect, I mean, we just didn't do a lot for gifts and stuff like that, because we didn't want it to be about consumerism and getting a bunch of stuff. But what that did remind me, the worst two gifts I ever got from a family member, just in case family members are listening to this, I'll keep it anonymous, but they'll know. But the two worst was one, when I was like 8, someone gave me a card that said, I donated your money to... like a nonprofit, like it wasn't a homeless thing. It was like an overseas thing, like an evangelical charitable organization. And I'm like, I'm 8. Like, I'm not going to understand that. Yeah. Like, you actually think I'm going to be grateful for that?
You don't have enough guilt yet to feel good about that, right?
So exactly. I was so bummed. I was kind of pissed actually.
Oh, gosh.
And then the same family member a couple of years later, I was like probably 12 or 13, got me like Ninja Turtle soap.
Okay.
From like the dollar store. I was like a teenager. I was like, what am I supposed to do with this?
Thank you.
Yeah.
What do I do? Yeah.
Have you gotten any terrible gifts?
I do remember getting socks once from somebody. I was like, okay, this is it. We all have to have that experience once in our lives, you know. And once I got a book, I mean, my mom, she meant well. It's just a book like, I didn't even know what it was. Like, I don't read books anyway at the age of 12. And especially this one. It's like, I think my mom was trying to help me. Or once she got me cassette tapes of Christmas music that I'll never listen to. I just, but they meant well. I think she was trying to help me in life or something, expand my horizons. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I've got a slew of things that I didn't like. But generally, I do have good memories of getting things, of being a good consumer.
Yeah. Okay, well, then before we move on to the Bible part of our episode, what was your favorite Christmas gift you ever got?
Oh, my. I really wanted, as a kid, I wanted to have a pool table. And we couldn't because our house was too small. And you need room.
Yeah, for sure. You almost have to have like a room for it.
You have to like a 20 by 20 room. We just didn't have that. I think our house is 20 by 20. But anyway, I got, though, a small make-believe pool table once. It was a bumper pool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, instead of cues, you have this thing you hold in your hand and it's spring-loaded. And you push the thing back and you press a button. Boom, and it kicks it out. And that was a nice gift. And we also got a not really good air hockey table once.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved air hockey. So, I mean, those are gifts I remember, and it's all good. I get to a point, it's like, they're all just memories and they part of who you've been. That's all.
Yeah. That's funny. You saying that. I remember getting probably those same gifts, air hockey table. Yeah. I always loved that stuff.
Yeah.
But my favorite for sure blew all the others out was when I was 16. So my mom and I share a love of Tar Heel basketball.
Oh.
So, and shared because I was indoctrinated by my mom from a very young age to love Tar Heel basketball. So, middle school, I was like obsessed.
That's North Carolina.
North Carolina, University of North Carolina.
For people who are not into Tar Heel
basketball. North Carolina at Chapel Hill basketball.
Yeah.
And I was really into it. Middle school, high school, tried to watch every game. And yeah, I woke up for my 16th Christmas of my, because I wanted to go to the University of North Carolina because of the basketball team.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But for my 16th Christmas, I went in to the living room and under the tree was just this like
plastic Dean Smith.
I wish he was just there to greet me. A plastic plane. And I was like, I'm 16. Why am I getting a plastic plane?
Mm-hmm.
And my mom got tickets for us to go fly. It was my first trip east of the Mississippi because I grew up in Texas. I'd never been east of the Mississippi. Okay. We flew to Chapel Hill and watched them play the Maryland basketball team.
Wow.
Like that spring.
That's cool.
Yeah. So that was really cool.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons. Oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes von Persil.
All right. So,
so,
I mean, part of the reason we wanted to talk about our traditions and what that is for us is to talk about this distinction between maybe the official tradition or celebration of holidays or of anything religious, right? Christmas is a religious holiday at this point, you know, probably pagan before it was Christian, but there's like the official celebration, the liturgy, the Advent, this is how we as Christians globally celebrate Christmas. And then there's like the real people stuff, you know, like Santa Claus. I don't see Santa Claus in the Bible, but there's, even for me growing up, there was a lot more Santa Claus than there was church stuff. And so we just wanted to talk about that because there's some parallels with what we see in our Bibles versus kind of the real, what actually happened in Israelite culture? What was going on? And we make the assumption that the Bible reflects that, but archaeologists tell us something different.
Right. There's an interesting analogy there. But I mean, I think of Christmas as, if you were to ask people, what's Christmas about? I imagine you might get a cluster of answers that have a lot of overlap. It's about Jesus's birth and the Bethlehem, and they would tell part of the Christmas story and things like that. But the way people actually celebrate it it's just all over the place. You know, like, I mean, for us, you know, speaking of Christmas tradition, like, what marked Christmas? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, right? That claymation thing that, whatever that technique is called, or Frosty the Snowman or Charlie Brown Christmas. I mean, that was powerfully meaningful to us, you know, and some people watch He-Man and She-Ra Christmas and things like that, you know, but those for us were, that was as meaningful as any other things that we did as
yeah, I think movies in general, I mean, yes. For our family, beginning of Christmas is always Elf. We watch Elf.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I think movies really have a lot, I think, of impact around Christmas.
Right. And The Bells of St. Mary, that was Bing Crosby. And
yeah,
and,
It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, right.
There's a lot to do. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is important. But, and people have different traditions that they do, different things that have nothing to do with official Christmas whatsoever. You know, and again, it's a little bit reductionistic to say official Christmas because that is a moving target too. But basically, you know, when you look at the Christian tradition historically, ice skating isn't part of it, you know, or watching TV or a movie is not part of it, or Black Friday is not a part of it, all that kind of stuff, you know, a very consumer society we live in, obviously. So it struck me years ago that there is sort of the official thing about Christmas, which is floating up in the air someplace, but it touches down in ways that's very diverse and very weird. And oftentimes is not at all a part of official Christmas. And in fact, may even be very much in conflict with it. And for me, I can see in just the Bible as a whole, how, you know, in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, you have the condemnation of idols like Asherah, right? And these little figurines that, we know about them because they were found, they were discovered, which is sort of the point I'm trying to make here. But these worshiping of these idols is something that the biblical prophets say, you don't do that. That's, you eradicate that. And so the official religion is no idols at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they found hundreds and hundreds of these little figurines in like 7th century Judah, which is really late. You know, the exile's coming in a few decades, right? And that suggests that there's a real disjunction between the official religion, what you're told you're supposed to do, and then what people were actually doing.
Yeah, and
on the ground.
For me, just the practical import of that was, it was such a huge relief to recognize that fact, because I grew up with an understanding that the Bible, that religious people, the ancient Jews, which I of course projected as Christians because I was young, just I thought we were all kind of the same thing, but they were perfect back then. Like, they did it all right. They were organized. It's kind of like a moment of, if we could just get back to the good old days. And then to realize, like, no, there's always been this like projection of what we, the ideal, the law or the model that we're supposed to follow, and then real life. And for someone who likes to be a perfectionist or kind of is very intense about trying to get to that perfection, mm-hmm. or that idealistic state, it was a huge relief to say, oh, even back then they didn't really practice the official thing. It just is helpful. And then to see that import today, whether it's Christmas, which I think is a very innocent example, but I think we could draw parallels to other examples of, we, this almost came out of my mouth. I said, well, we all fall short, right? A little Romans like glitch. We all fall short of the glory of God, but it's like, we all fall short of the ideal thing. So maybe that's okay. Maybe that's not the point.
And the ideal maybe even be a fantasy too.
Yeah. And the ideal maybe, as we learned from Joel Baden this season and some others, maybe there's some propaganda or some, maybe it's not as pure of heart as we think it is, that ideal.
And, you know, I think about how 2000 years from now, people are aware of the official tradition of Christmas, but then, yeah, I guess all people back then went to church and did all that kind of stuff. But then they start digging, you know, archaeologically or whatever, and they say, no, they're watching He-Man and She-Ra, or they're watching Rudolph, or they're getting trees and decorating. What the heck's that?
I mean, they worship this fat dude with the beard.
All that kind of stuff.
Or maybe this is how they've depicted God back then.
Yeah, exactly. It must be some sort of a cult figure here. Actually, it sort of is. But the thing is that it's through archaeology that we have learned what religion on the ground might have looked like for people. And again, the disjunction between the official and the non-official. And, you know, some people have had a lot of sympathy for the Israelites, saying they're just being ancient people at this point, you know. And, you know, it says, you know, you shall have no other gods before me. That might not say you can't have some alongside or maybe hang out in the back.
Well, and when there's drought going on and there's this god like the Asherah of fertility that may actually
help us
eat.
It works for my neighbor and we want to fit in.
Right. So, we want to fit in and we want to eat.
Right. And we want to eat. Right. So. Right. So I just find that to be very, very interesting that the official and the real don't always sync very well, you know, and there is something there. There's a lesson to be learned about the nature of the Bible itself because of who wrote it. And the people who wrote could write, and they wrote, right? Not everybody.
Right.
And they had reasons for writing what they did and compiling things the way that they did. And not sinister reasons, but they just had reasons to do that. And here we have this Bible, and you know, I think sometimes we walk around thinking that people in the Old Testament read the Bible. We do. I'm sure they do too. No, they didn't have a Bible. So how do you get these traditions? Well, you get them through like normal means. They just organically arise perhaps. But then the Bible is written, but it's also edited and it's also compiled at a much later time. And so at that point, we're getting a later official version, or maybe even that version is a little bit Pollyanna, a little bit pie in the sky. Like this is how we envision our story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to get off track, but things like the tabernacle is probably envisioned by later Israelites with a temple ideology and projecting that back into a wilderness period that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. You know, so
it makes me think of, I work with a lot of, in my other life, I work with a lot of family businesses, and we talk about their values. And it's funny that a lot of people, I'm very big on this because a lot of companies or families or whatever, when I ask, what are your values? Most of the time, what they'll tell me is their aspirational values, what they wish were true about themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The thing about companies, the funny part is you can actually look and see
what they actually do.
Right. And you're like, wait, you're saying you value this, but I don't see the evidence for that. But it's interesting that people's innate initial thing, when they say, what do you value? They tell me what they wish they valued.
Right.
And that sounds similar. Like when we're writing these things down, we're geared toward the hope or the future or the like aspirational part of what we wish were the case, almost as like if we write it down this way, it becomes true somehow.
Well, James Kugel, who we've had on the podcast, he said something once about how the Bible is the Israelites on their best behavior.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But the reality of it might be more dirty. In fact, there may be agendas on the part of the biblical writers to clean up some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you're not going to have books like 1st and 2nd Kings that are railing against idols in Israel and Baal and Asherah. The only reason they're railing against it is because it's happening. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but it's wrong. Okay, that's fine. But just understand the disjunction between the people on the farmers and the peasants and the elite people who could actually read and write, who were telling these stories, who, I mean, not to sound like Marxist or something, but there is a power dimension too, to being able to write stories and narratives where people can be controlled. So we're sort of ruining Christmas right now, or at least the Bible a little bit again, you know, and I'm not suggesting that we've just explained the entire Bible. It's propaganda and it's power
moves.
It's
more that there's a factor that you have to account for.
Yeah.
How it accounts, more or less, it depends maybe even on each book in terms of the influence of these sorts of things. But I think it's just recognize that these dynamics and these pieces are at play.
Well, speaking of which, should we talk about the Christmas stories?
Yeah.
So want to get into that?
Yeah, I think I did. I kind of wanted to start with talking about this real on the ground practice versus sort of the idealized version of things. This past year, I taught junior high at my church once a month. I was the teacher for junior high, and I got the class right before Christmas. And so what I did was I put this PowerPoint together, and I just put up like 30 different depictions of the birth narrative of Jesus in art.
Yeah.
You know, like medieval, ancient, and then up to, there were some current ones, but from different cultures, like some African depictions, Asian, South American. And I just kind of showed, we just went through it and we just started pointing out, we read the birth narrative first out of the Bible. So they had like a baseline. And then we just started looking at like 30 pictures, and I wanted them to point out, where are their differences? Like, well, that's not, we didn't read that. That's not in the story. And then at the end, though, we talked about why would they maybe have done that? Not to make fun of the medieval theologian or artist who put Jesus in front of a castle. There were plenty of those.
With nobility watching or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of nobility. Yeah. Yeah. There's like this almost like, it was very strange. Just like, why are we now in like 11th century France all of a sudden in this Jesus? Yeah. Jesus is in 11th century France. But we talked about why maybe would they do that? But it was fascinating to see all of these pieces and to have kind of light bulbs go off for these kids of like, oh, they never thought of it. But then their first thought was, oh, these guys are dumb. Like, they're wrong. Like, why would you do that?
How could they get it so wrong?
Yeah. Right. And then, because the latest ones, though, were 21st century American depictions. And then they were like, oh,
wait, Jesus.
We do that, too. We do it, too. So, yeah, let's maybe talk about some
of those.
That's
a great lesson, by the way, to teach kids.
Yeah, I think it's a great. Yeah. I mean, maybe even for those of you who are listening, just like go Google these depictions.
In my opinion, this is how I explain that phenomenon. And you probably did this with your kids, but it's natural to bring the ancient story into your present moment and to present it in ways that make sense to you. Yeah. I think some of these art paintings were commissioned by rich people and they put themselves in it as like, as they're weird, but still, you know, we want to, you know, actualize the term, that's a term, actualize it to make it present for us. And so we depict things in ways we understand. That's very, very natural.
And I don't think it's quote unquote wrong to do that. I think it's just know that you're doing it.
Right.
It's the awareness to say it so that you're not saying this depiction is actually how it was.
It's like interpreting the Bible. We do
exactly
the same thing, right?
So yeah, that's kind of the object lesson here.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the way Jesus is depicted in the four Gospels illustrates the point too, you know, because only two of them even bother to have birth narratives, and they tell them very differently in ways that they're not utterly incompatible, but they have two very different, you know, Matthew and Luke to have birth narratives. Mark doesn't bother.
Yeah. And John
John's
has
too
this
concerned about talking
mystical
about
mystical.
Exactly. No, it's very mystical and philosophical, right? And it's a whole different thing. But, you know, Matthew and Luke tell the story differently. And the reason they do is for the same reason people paint these portraits of Madonna and child or whatever, because they're trying to say something to the community around them.
Can you maybe, let's just talk about a few of those differences, and then let's talk about the narrative and maybe how we understand that narrative in a way. There's some inaccuracies historically to kind of, if you go to your, you know, Hallmark store and buy a nativity set, there's a lot of inaccuracies in that depiction from the biblical narrative.
Exactly.
But,
right.
But let's talk first about not the cultural disconnect, but even the biblical disconnect between Matthew and Luke.
Right. I mean, just, you know, briefly, Matthew's gospel, the birth narrative, that's where you get the wise men, not three wise men. And we don't know their names either, you know, despite what Christmas cards say. That's one of those, we'll get into that. But
yeah, I always love the old adage, we three kings of Orient are.
Yeah.
There's not three, they're not kings, and they're not from the Orient.
Yeah, exactly right. So, sorry, we ruined that Christmas carol you. But so you have that, and you have, this is the gospel where Matthew, where Herod massacres the children. And that's why the wise men or the magi are properly called.
They're, yeah, can we stop back there for a second? Because I love, the great irony for me lately is that we call them wise men, but there's a case to be made that they're also astrologers.
Yeah, magicians.
Reading the stars.
Exactly right, right.
you know? So it just is funny to me that I did, you know, in conservative circles, like tarot readings and all of that's like witchcraft right. and like completely not okay.
Yeah.
And then like the birth narrative starts with people who read the stars.
And I think you can say wise men in an ancient sense,
right.
maybe in an Eastern sense.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that's the big context. We don't have our kids do in the Christmas pageants, right? Like, here, go be an astrologer and you can.
Well, and it leads you to, I mean, it's just such on point. It's right. like, if you read the stars, it leads you to Jesus.
Yeah. right. Well, yeah.
All right. Anyway.
Although that's, yeah, anyway.
Keep going on. So that. Matthew has the astrologers, but Matthew has the Herod account, which
is. The Herod account, which is to kill the infants 2 years old, up to 2 years old. And
that's because the wise men have told Herod that there's this person born mm-hmm. that is going to be a king, and Herod freaks out and says,
right.
kill the babies.
And that suggests that these wise men, the Magi, again, leaving aside historical things, just the logic of the narrative, it suggests that they didn't show up the night Jesus was born. They showed up maybe sometime later, and then they found him. And that's why Herod, for 2 years old or younger, just those are the ones you kill, right?
Right. Yeah, so let's just do both of these at the same time
yeah.
because you've mentioned it now. If you're following along with your nativity set from Hallmark, there isn't necessarily three of these Magi.
Correct.
We only assume that because there's three gifts, and they weren't there the night Jesus was born. So any set that has three Magi and a giant mm-hmm. star
right.
is it doesn't follow the narrative of
right.
what we have.
Right.
He might have been a toddler. Jesus might have been up to two, and it was probably then not where Jesus was born, but where he lived. And so that, yeah, carry on. So
it gets
kind of,
it gets mushed up a little bit, even in the biblical story, but that's, you know, it's almost like reading between the lines a little bit, what's going on here. And also the nativity said, if you have angels singing, you need to get them out of there. At least that's not Matthew's story. That's Luke's story.
Luke's.
And Luke has, you know, this is when Quirinius was governor and, you know, they came down for a census for taxation, which historians will tell you is highly, highly suspect for a number of reasons, leaving that aside for now. But you also have, this is where Gabriel appears to Mary. In Matthew's gospel, it's an angel appears to Joseph in a dream. Joseph has a couple of dreams where he's told what to do. But now it's Gabriel talking to Mary, announcing the birth, and that's when she visits her cousin slash relative Elizabeth and John mm-hmm. the Baptist. And this is where also the angels appear to the shepherds, you know, the Linus moment in the Charlie Brown Christmas, mm-hmm. you know, here's what the meaning of Christmas is. And he reads from Luke. So you, and of course in our Christmas pageants or Christmas cards, these things are all sort of mushed
right.
together.
Consolidate
as one
all of this
thing.
So they can be in one
right.
scene.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to get into this too much, but Matthew's gospel very much has a Moses connection. Jesus mm-hmm. is Moses 2.0, so to speak.
That's what I was going to mention, because in yeah. Matthew, which I think we run over often in the birth narrative, is they go to Egypt.
Right.
Jesus actually lives in Egypt for a
right.
while.
And comes back.
And comes back, yeah. you know, to fulfill Hosea 11:1, out yeah. of Egypt I've called my son, which
yeah.
there's, you know, a lot to talk about there. But there's also the Moses connection.
The Moses connection, which is, you know, Joseph is told in a dream that those who want to kill you or kill Jesus have died, and now it's safe to go back. And that's almost verbatim in Exodus chapter 4, where Moses is hiding in Midian, and it's okay to go back now because all those who are seeking your life are dead. And read any commentary in Matthew to say this is very intentional, right? So you have two stories of a threat to children in the Moses story, right? And now in the Jesus story, and they're sort of like they're playing off of each other a little bit.
Yeah, you're supposed to be saying, oh, this reminds me of someone
exactly
else.
Right. Yeah, right.
So Jesus is like Moses.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. Jesus, I mean, that's that there is a lot of Moses stuff going on in the Gospel of Matthew in general. And then Luke is, the way I interpret it, Luke, is a little bit different. He's not really making a Moses connection.
It's a little more political.
It's a little
say.
More political. Yeah. He's more. The language that Gabriel uses to Mary and the language we see in the angelic announcement to the shepherds has been compared to something called the Priene Calendar inscription, which is from 9 BC. It's before Jesus' birth, celebrating the birth of the god Augustus, who brings peace to the world and whose birth is the beginning of the good news, which is, that's how Mark's gospel starts, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ. So the suggestion there is that, well, it's Jesus's birth that truly gives good news. It's Jesus's birth. Jesus is better than Caesar.
Yeah,
that's really
it's
what it comes
poking
down
at
to.
The Roman Empire,
right.
Much more in Luke.
A little bit more.
Which follows again. Yeah. This isn't just, we're not just making this up willy-nilly. It's thematic throughout the book too.
Right,
it's confirmed again and again that this is the theme in the same way that Matthew again and again, Sermon on the Mount, other things are connecting him to Moses.
And I guess there are some things that we believe today about Christmas that we think are tied to the biblical text, but they're not. And the big one, I think, is the merging of the two stories, which, okay, you got to have kids have parts, and the more the better. Like, how much you can have untold number of angels if you want to.
And animals. Angels and animals, you can have innumerable.
And you could, if you really want to be risky, have like 10 magi. Or 100. It doesn't. You can have as many as you want, folks. It doesn't say three.
It doesn't. Yeah, that's right.
They brought three gifts. Doesn't mean there's three of them. And we don't know their names. It's not Caspar, Melchior, and Belshazzar, whatever their names are. We don't know the names. There are no names. There aren't three of them. Just drop that. But, you know, you merge them together, which clearly just sidesteps the theologies of Matthew and Luke. But of course, they're kids. Who cares? But still, grown-ups, you know, and we expect to see, like, why aren't they all together? Why there's not even an understanding that there are actually two different birth stories given in Matthew and Luke, which, you know, as adult readers, we should respect. As kids, we don't have to, but it's just part of the whole, I don't know, the fantasy of celebrating Christmas and what we think of, you know?
Well, I do, but if I can be a little bit more cynical than that, I think it's also this assumption that the Bible speaks with one voice, so it kind of doesn't matter.
Yes, right.
We can pull it from Matthew. We can pull it from Luke. It doesn't matter. And I feel like that's just disrespectful to what we actually have in the text, because Matthew has a coherent story for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's there for a reason, and so is Luke is for a reason. It feels like we're just willy-nilly, but I think it does betray this deeper understanding of what is the Bible.
Right.
You know, what can we do with it? I mean, if it's all from the same source and it all says the same thing, then by all means, put them together.
Another thing is, you know, this is not a huge point, but the whole thing of Mary on a donkey, there's no donkey in the gospel stories, you know? So now the thing is that, okay, she's preggers. So, you know, maybe it's reasonable that she's not walking, but still, like, it's an assumption
being made. Still a filling in the gap.
Filling in the gap, right. So it's just, and we tend to do that with these stories. We fill in the gap, and not just in how we tell them, but how it's depicted in art. You mentioned that before. You've got all these different, here's a story, any story of the Bible, and somebody tells you, draw a picture of it. You're going to have to make some decisions.
Like, Mary has to get from A to B somehow.
She's got to get.
It doesn't specify.
Right, right.
Could be walking, could be a donkey. We don't know.
I was just talking with some of my students at Eastern. We're going through Genesis and the story of the binding of Isaac in Genesis 22. And the story is so laconic. It's just so gapped.
Which means it has holes in it.
Has holes in
it. Use normal words, Pete.
That is a normal word. They can look
it up. Laconic is not normal. It's a Bible for normal people.
Google it.
I'm going to buzz you.
I know you should. I'm sorry. I'm a bad person. So, but there are so many holes in the story, unexplained things. And the question always comes up, did Isaac just go along with this? I mean, does he, like, there's no complaint at all. And you look at art and you see some where Isaac, who's depicted as like a teenager at this point, he might not be that old, but so he's lying there just very calm and serene. Like, I'm going to do God's will here. Mm-hmm. There are others where Isaac is like screaming his head off, Dad, what are you doing? And the thing is that, like, how do you depict that? And so in art, you have to make decisions. And in Christmas cards, you have to make decisions. And in Christmas carols, you have to make decisions. And we're always having to make decisions from these stories about what to depict, even if they're not really anchored in the text itself. Right.
And some of it too is a lack of understanding. And this is where, you know, making the case for why it's important to have biblical scholarship and to try to understand the context and archaeology. I'm thinking of the idea that there's no room for Jesus at the inn. you know, growing up, I would have pictured like a motel, honestly, because I didn't have a context. Like, what do you mean? And it says inn. Like, okay. Instead of probably what the case was, which if, you know, archaeologists have kind of shown us what houses in that part of the world were like at the time of Jesus's birth. And you had your animals in the house with you, you know, on the first floor and then you stayed above them. And so,
and stayed a little warm because of their poop.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's good. Right. Yeah. So even that understanding, because again, I can't imagine how many theological points have been made over the last 50 years about there was no room for Jesus at the inn. And so he had to be born out in the far away from everyone else. Yeah. And it's just not accurate. Yeah.
You got to sleep in the garage.
Right. Yes. You got to sleep in the garage and we just happen to keep our animals in the garage.
Right. Right. Yeah. Some people do actually. So, but it's like a house where you have the garage is attached.
Right.
And there's a bedroom.
And there's an apartment on top.
That's more what this thing is. And also the whole thing about in a manger is highly suspect what that even means. Mm-hmm. But we got this thing like a feeding trough or something. Maybe. I don't know. But I mean, some of these things we just don't know. We have to fill in the gaps.
Right. But some of it we kind of do know is my point too. It's like, but it's why it's important to be educated on some of this. I mean, I don't want to oversell that, but I think it is important.
Which amounts to having a Bible with decent notes. That's really what that amounts to. And if people are interested, it's not about...
Well, and supporting actual scholarship. That's not just theologically driven where we're just going to baptize our interpretation that we've held for the last 300 or 400 years or last 100 years and just defend that. Because archaeology, if it's going to be a field that produces real knowledge, can't be beholden to faith statements and things that we have to just confirm. We have to be open to whether it's archaeologists finding, you know, innocent things like that. Maybe first century houses didn't look like that. Maybe a little bit more risque to say they worshipped Asherahs probably in the day-to-day practice of religion. Maybe more controversial to say Jericho probably didn't fall the way the Bible says it did. Maybe the taxation and census, the way Luke presents it, didn't happen. So we have to be open to all that.
And there are things that scholarship can actually help us with there, you know, just hard data,
exactly,
so to speak, right?
Exactly.
Not everything is hard data, but some things are. And yeah, I think this is a lesson for just the Bible as a whole. And Christmas is a good contextual way to do this because it's Christmas time, but it's illustrating a larger point.
Exactly.
Which is not, you know, as a professor of mine said many years ago, it's not that the Bible is a pack of lies. It's just that it's a highly contextual document. And people who look to the Bible for spiritual guidance or sustenance or information, we are invariably going to take those stories and make them our own and have visions of these things. Again, you know, the Christmas card Holy Family in our part of the world tends to be fairly white.
Right.
Right. And on one level, I get it if it weren't for the fact that this is the dominant culture and there were problems with racism in America. But I understand that, you know, I've seen once, not to, you know, make fun of Baptists, but why not? But, you know, a conservative Baptist in our area for Vacation Bible School, there was a, you know, picture of Jesus. I swear to you, he's got short blonde hair, not touching his ears, parted on the side. I mean,
no way.
It was, and I looked at it and I said, that's a little bit too far, I think. That's
I know, usually you at least far. Keep long hair on Jesus at least, if you're going to turn him white.
He had short, like banker hair, but it was blonde. It was a shocking blonde. Oh, it was beautiful. Goodness. But, you know, I look at that and I say, that's wrong. But the principle is not wrong. In fact, it's universal. And we know that from art. We know that from the history of interpretation of the text. That's
right.
All, that's
even
what we do.
With these, you know, junior hires in Sunday school, the reason I wanted to bring it up to the present day was to show them other cultures where in Africa, you know, the Madonna and Child, they are black and they're dressed more in an African style. And in Asia, same thing. And in South America and saying, you know, again, there's some power dynamics. And I think that's important to pay attention to, but also recognize it can be a beautiful thing. It can be, it can be an appropriate thing to say. And this is where, you know, sometimes I feel like on the show, even we talk out of both sides of our mouths. And I am okay with that, where it is, we need to respect and be grounded in the scholarship. We need to know that Jesus was not a white person. And we also need to have an imagination and be creative about how we bring that ancient tradition to our lives today. And it, I think it's, for me, the reason it's not a disingenuous or a lack of integrity is to be fully self-aware of what you're doing, when you're doing it, and why you're doing it. That, for me, is the critical issue.
So it's not, what you're saying then, it's not, watching He-Man and She-Ra Christmas, mm-hmm. right, is not wrong because it's not original. Go ahead and watch it, but understand just what's happening here. Or maybe it gives you a chance to be like, I'm not even aware that I'm doing this kind of stuff, but be more reflective. And some people might say, you know, I don't think I want to keep this tradition or that tradition anymore. I want to decide not to do that because I want to be maybe not more faithful to like the original, to the biblical story, which is, it's impossible to celebrate Christmas, by the way, folks, if all you do is stick with the biblical story, because the church very quickly celebrated it, you know, the Christ Mass, that's where we get Christmas from. That was what they used to do back in the old days, you know, and that's why we go to church on Christmas Eve or whatever. So,
but the Bible doesn't actually tell us to celebrate
it. But the Bible
it.
Doesn't say anything about that, right? Because, you know, Jesus wasn't worshiped like that, you know, and back in the day. So yeah, I think you're right. I agree with that. I think it's a matter of just being introspective about it and maybe not judging other people's traditions. And, you know, listen, if a Charlie Brown Christmas just makes you happy,
right,
it brings back memories of childhood. And it's not like Christmas is for children. It's not that. It's more like you're even connecting with your whole soul. And if it's through that, so be it. And that's fine. And that can be a part of this whole process of thinking about what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Well, and as Americans, and this may not be true for all of our listeners who are in other cultures that have maybe held on to traditions better than we have.
Yeah.
For me, I'm like, my goodness, just hold on to any tradition.
Anything.
To help us feel connected to each other and to our past, because we have obliterated so much of that.
Right.
If that's watching Elf or Charlie Brown Christmas, by all means, mm-hmm. do it. Yeah. All right. Well, that's kind of everything. I hope we ruined Christmas adequately for everyone. Yeah.
And the way we ruin other things, which is to give a little bit of spark of where to go.
Yeah.
Not too much, though.
Yeah. We ruin one version of Christmas and hopefully inspire a new one for yourselves.
And speaking of inspiration, you know, in a few weeks, we'll be back.
Yeah, we'll be
in
back.
In a few weeks.
For season 7.
A lot of surprises, a lot of fun stuff happening there, folks.
See you then. Stay tuned.
See ya.
You've just made it through another episode of The Bible for Normal People. Thanks to our listeners who support us each week by rating the podcast, leaving a review, and telling others about our show. We couldn't have made this amazing episode without the help of our producers group. Jeff Paulus, Eric Latassi, Ryan Bond, Lauren O'Connell, Brad Harris, Joel Thompson, Jacqueline Van Beek, Chuck Beam, Joel Herring, and Jerry L. Lewis. As always, you can support the podcast at patreon.com/thebibleformalpeople, where for as little as $3 a month, you can receive bonus material, be part of an online community, get course discounts, and much more. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team, Brittany Prescott, Savannah Locke, Stephanie Spate, Tessa Stoltz, Nick Striegel, Stephen Henning, Haley Warren, Jessica Shao, and Natalie Wyand.
That's sort of what Christmas means to me.
So heartwarming. I feel like we need a hearth.
Hearth.